We left off in the Gemara on the bottom of Zayin Amud Beis. And the Gemara here is now going to talk about some very important issues of communal matters. If you look in the Rishonim here, and particularly in the Mordechai especially, you get a lot of this. This daf has enormous relevance to their daily lives in Europe. Now, that may seem strange to you, but when you consider that communities, number one, were very small. Number two, taxes were very significant. When I say very significant, I don't mean as a number per se, but Masim played a major role. There's a line in the Rush here, which is a stunning line, which speaks to his perception of the surrounding non-Jews, which might not have been totally wrong, but might not have been wrong at all. But he writes, he says, in Simon Chavtes, in our para, he writes, Ki mato eles yesh leksas ovde kochavim mazalos, banu lishomreinu ulhoshiva sona beinehem, ele bishvil hana'o shenei osim me'es Yisrael, legabos mehem masim va'arnonios. So the Rush doesn't say that the Christians, some of them tolerate the Jews amongst themselves because of the Augustinian doctrine of the witness, but rather because they can collect taxes from us. I suspect that the Rush's perspective is probably truer than the perspective of the Augustinian doctrine. So you also have the Tosefta, the Rif quotes it, and the Rush quotes it. Talks about obligations that Bnei Ha'ir have to one another. So you're obligated, you can force other members of the community to build a Beis HaKnesses. And that means to and acquire Sefer Torah as well. And one of the things not mentioned in the Tosefta, but the Rishonim say, the Rishonim say is that you can force people to contribute to a minyan. Now, what does contributing to a minyan mean? So, I once visited a particular secular college campus, and I was talking to the JLIC rabbi. I came to give a shiur, and he told me that I said, you know, what's the minyanim story there? So he said they don't always get shachas during the week. I said, why? And it's not that there aren't enough people. I mean, I don't think it's a huge sprawling thing. But he said, he actually identified a particular yeshiva high school, you know, which had a lot of students in this particular place. And he said, the kids don't can't get to the front dominion. And what was shocking to me, what was absolutely shocking to me, was that it's one thing not to daven in the minion, and even not to daven, which is obviously not to daven is b'chol, obviously usher. But it's another thing when your community needs you. When your community needs you. I was told about a student, in contrast, who came from a community that some of you well know, where a majority of the school and probably the main shul linked to it are not Shomer Shabbos, and yet went to some school in the Midwest, and there was no, like, what things weren't going on. And so he, who might not have been normally a minyan goer, took it upon himself to make sure that there would be a minyan. So there's a sense, there's a difference between, you can discuss the obligation of an individual to go to minyan versus the obligation of an individual to make sure that there's a minyan in the community, in the communal obligation. So today, okay, imagine you're in YU, it's like, what, you can't get a minyan, you're in Teaneck, New Jersey. We have multiple shuls now, like minyan factories. But in medieval Europe, it was very common that Jewish communities would be a very small number of individuals. When you see the tshuva of Rabbeinu Gershom, of the Maram Yurtenberg, the tshuva about Yirsha Kula Kohanim, so you kind of wonder, like, Yirsha Kula Kohanim, that'd be amazing, right? Imagine your shul has a membership of 450 families, 400 families, 100 families, even 50 families. Yirsha Kula Kohanim? So the answer is no. If you have a handful of families in the community, they're all related to one another, and you might not have more than 20 Jews, 30 Jews total, and all Canadian state families. So of course you can have an Yirsha Kula Kohanim. It's perfectly conceivable. So in circumstances where you have such small communities, so there's a lot of literature in the Rishonim. The Mordechai has a great arichus here about, let's say you want to leave. You want to leave for Yom Tov, and especially Yom Noraim, and there's not going to be minions, so you have to be master of someone in your place. What if there are 11 people, 11 men, I should be very careful about that, 11 men who can count towards the minion, and one of them wants to leave, it's fine. What if two want to leave? How do they do it? And so on. So these are issues that for us would seem kind of silly. You have to hire someone to be there for a minion, but for them it was a really big deal. And the conceptual underpinnings of the discussion lie in this sukkah, the obligations of B'nai Chatzer, B'nai Mavui, B'nai Ha'ir, to providing the needs of the city. Okay. Now, one of the very important issues that comes up as well now, immediately, is a question that relates to, I'll call it taxation, is that how are obligations assessed? So, imagine a person comes into the through a room, and there are 10 people there, and says, I want $100, and if you don't give me $100, I'm going to kill every single one of you. So how much does each one have to contribute? So one could argue that in that particular case, perhaps one should contribute each person $10. It doesn't matter that one of them is Nelson Rockefeller, and one of them is the Oni Shabaniyim, because it's basically nefashos, and every human being's soul is worth the same thing, so the obligation should fall upon all of them equally. Now, that might be different than a situation where a person basically comes in and is going to rob everybody unless they put a certain amount of money and give them a certain amount of money to buy them off. In such a case, one would understand that the proper thing probably to do would be lefi mama, because if he's going to come and rob me, if you're worth $1 million and I'm worth $1,000, well, guess what? You have a lot more to lose, if he comes and just decides to do whatever he's going to rob us all. So these are the kinds of factors that are sort of lurking in the background when the Gemara begins the following discussion. And remember, we're talking about even raiders, marauders who are coming. So when we talk about building a choma, the lasayim uvriach, which is for the protection of the city, so why the cities require protection primarily? Certainly now and even in the Talmudic period, do raiders come into cities to kill people or to steal their stuff? Mostly to steal their stuff. So the Gemara says the following, about 9 lines from the bottom, or 10 lines from the bottom. Oh no, it's a little higher, 12. Boim yinei Rav Elazar mei Rabbi Yochanan, kishen govin lefi nefrashos govin, odum lefi shvach mamon govin. Do they collect based upon just, the same amount per person? And if you had a family with multiple souls in it, so then you would pay proportion to that. Or do ma lefi shvach mamon govin? Do you pay based upon how much money you have? Amar le, lefi mamon govin. Elazar b'ni kva b'mas meiros. Rav Elazar was Rav Yochanan's Talmud. You should remember that. There's a famous, I think it's a passage of the Bava, I don't remember if it's in the Yerushalmi, where Rav Elazar was, it's in Yigbar Yivamas. Rav Elazar was citing stuff, and somehow he didn't attribute it to Rav Yochanan. Rav Yochanan got angry. And somebody was trying to appease Rav Yochanan and said, look, when Yeshua ben Nun would say something, he didn't say every time he gave over a sukkah, he didn't say, Kach Amar Li Moshe Rabbi, because everybody understood he was a Talmud of Moshe Rabbeinu, so everything that he had learned had come from Moshe. So he says the same thing is true about your student Elazar. When he says something, everybody assumes that that's the Shimcha, so he doesn't have to say that, Amar Rabbi. That's how he tried to piece him. So here, Rabbi Yochanan says to him, Elazar b'ni, Kvabai Mesmeris. They said, the halacha is, lefi mamon, and nail it in. Keep it solid. Don't depart from this. This is halacha kavua. And then, Ikadamri, there's another version. B'ayim yinei Rabbi Elazar b'Yochanan, chen govin lefi ki rebatam, and govin lefi mamon govin. Do you collect based upon how close you are to the walls of the city? Meaning the question is proximity means you're more danger. Oh, do you say Dilma Lafi Mamon Govin? Do you do it based upon simply your assets or Shvach Mamon? So Amar Lei Lafi Ki Rebatim Hin Govin, the Lazar B'ni Kvaba Masmeros. Tosos and all the Rishonim, the Rimigash and Tosos all say that when the answer is given Lafi Ki Rebatim, it doesn't mean and not Lafi Shvach Mamon. It's both. And what they say is that if you have someone who's closer to the wall, who's wealthy, and someone who's further away from the wall is wealthy, the person who's closer to the wall, who's wealthy, will pay more than the person who's farther away and wealthy. And when you have a person who's poor is close to the wall, and a person who's poor farther away, the one who's close to the wall will pay more. But when you have two people close to the wall, one's an usher, one's an ani, the usher is still going to pay more. Now, it's not only lefiki rabatim, it's also lefiki rabatim. It's a factor that's taken into account, but it's not the exclusive factor. Generally speaking, and not all from a yidden, I happen to like this as a theology, but generally speaking, Chazal's attitude towards this is the Rishonim's attitude. It's the Rishonim tends to be, I don't want to call socialist, but it tends to lean more in that direction. It tends not to be the independent, each person is a unit in themselves, but a much, much more communitarian approach, which is generally the Torah's approach to a lot of economic issues. And we're going to see some of that's going to come up in our Gemara as well. It's going to come up, I think, on the very important Gemaras on Chas Amid Beis about the power of community. And it's very hard to sort of... I'll state this, and I said this before, the Torah is not socialist, the Torah is capitalist in terms of the halacha. Firstly, to be socialist means there's no such thing as private property. Communism is a form of government, it's not a form of economics. Socialism is the form of economics. And there's probably no Western country that is exclusively capitalist or exclusively socialist. It's always a spectrum. But the Torah certainly is in principle capitalist, and that we believe in private property. But it's much more communitarian than the classic, at least American ethos, the sense of the rugged individualist, each person for one's own, which again is a stereotype that doesn't necessarily mean that's truly, how everybody thinks, and almost everybody believes in somewhere on the spectrum. But certainly, when you study the economic principles or the economic theology or philosophy of Chazal, I don't mean economic philosophy in terms of, economics, the dismal science, but rather the morality or how a justly constructed economic society is, it is far less free market capitalist than some would posit in the United States of America. So the Rishonim tend to, even when you read this Gemara like this, that's just the Fikir Batim, and you could conclude it doesn't matter how much you're worth, all that matters is, and I understand the story, how close you are to the danger, so the answer is no, it's actually... In almost all the cases, the Rishonim say it's never really the fi nefashos alone. It's always the fi. Even when it's the fi nefashos, it means it's also the fi nefashos, or in this case, also the fi kirabatim, because there's a sense that fairness, whatever you think fairness is, you can't impose certain costs upon people who are poor. So the Gemara continues and says, Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, who is Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's grandson, a great grandson, who sometimes had testy relations with Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish was a shtikal hathed. You look in Sanhedrin and other places, Rabbi Yochanan sometimes had to make peace between Reish Lakish and the Beis HaNasi. Right? The Beis HaNasi weren't always such firm people. They did their things. In Sanhedrin, Reish Lakish got up and gave a drasha about people who make Avodah Zarah out of gold and silver. He says it refers to people who appoint Dayanim who are Amei Haaretz because of gold and silver, because they pay their way in. He was talking about the Beis HaNasi, who was responsible appointed Dayanim. So you have all sorts of stories like that. Reish Lakish was not, he was a little bit prickly, You can understand Reish Lakish's background too. He was a person who probably didn't put up with a lot of stuff from people. So Rabbi Yochanan, who was his brother-in-law, often had to be the peacemaker in between. See here, Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya was Rama Deshura Ad Rabbanon. There was no tax for building the wall of the city. Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya included the Rabbanon in it. It gave you the question?
Yeah, who is Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya?
Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya's grandson or great-grandson?
He's around the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, a grandson certainly would be easy because Rabbi Yochanan was really, we classify him as second. He's younger than Rav. And Rav is a Talmud of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. He could have been a little younger Rabbi Yehuda Nasi at this point, or Reish Lakish could have been older. So Reish Lakish wasn't terribly happy about that. Amar.
What's the difference between Rabbi and Rav?
What's that?
Rabbi does not say Mitana.
No, Rabbi and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi.
I'm saying that it's like Rebbe this,
Rebbe
that.
So I was referring to the proper names, Rebbe and Rav. Rabbi, but Rebbe is usually assumed to be Tana, Smicha, and Rav does not have Smicha. So in all the Tanoim we'll have Rebbe. Unless there's no title law in front of them. But the Amoraim, and sometimes Gersos really matter, because I think there's a Rav and a Ravasi, but there's also a Rebbeami and Rebbeami, there's a Ravami Ravasi, and a Rebbe Amir Vassi were not the same people, it would seem. So Amoraim in Bavel, typically speaking, really, aside from Rav, and Rav was his name, or Rav was really Rabbi Abba, Abba Richa. But if the Rav, the Amoraim in Bavel, then Asmicha, so there'll be Rav. And now, Moray Min Eretz Yisrael, Du'a Smicha. So, part of the challenge in general when you're learning a Gemara, if the name is ambiguous in terms of who it was, you have to figure out whether it's a manuscript issue. Because it's very, very common. You know, someone puts in a Rebbe, Rav, and Rebbe, we like to think that you don't abbreviate Rav with a Shtrich. When you see it with a Shtrich, it's Rebbe. But you have to check manuscripts to make sure that everything works out. That, you know.
So all the time in the Netzel, though?
There were a handful of Tadam in Chutz Laretz. Hananya was in Chutz Laretz. Others at certain times lived there. Yehuda ben Beseira lived in Nisbis and Itzivan in Turkey or Asia Minor.
Even though it's
not Smicha. Smicha is supposed to only be conveyed in Eretz Yisrael. It is only conveyed in Eretz Yisrael as a general rule. So when Rav got his Smicha before he made Yerida, right? The Gemara Sanhedrin says, Rav Chiya said to Rebbe, Ben Ochi Yorei Lebavel, and he gave him Yore Yad Yad Nebet Yate Bechoros Al Yater. The Gemara in the first paragraph of Sanhedrin, I think that's Hey Amid Beis or something like that, around there. The Beis Din Sharia. He was Matir Shem and Shalakum. His Beis Din.
Yeah, and they said that his Beis Din
is
very.
No. They didn't. His Beis Din was, in that regard, was okay, but they didn't want to be Matir. If you're Matir more than the Gemara, here's the sense. It's a Mishnah in Adios that says that Yosef and Yosef Hayyad, that on three different kulas that he had, the Korin Le Yosef Sharia. They called him Yosef the Permitter. Now remember, he was still like the Nasa, you know. Yeah, but so in Abu Dazara, they talk about one of you Matir something. He was Matir Shem and Shalakum. I forget what else they want. It was something in the get. There was a kula in the get about the timing when you give it, whether you hold like Rabbi Yosef, that Kala Omer. When you have a zman in the get, it means tmei achshav, as opposed to later, which is a kula legabe chalitza and so on. So they wanted to be matir 13, but they didn't do it because they didn't want to be called a beis din sharia. He's beis din, but I think they weren't matir the third place. So he assessed the tax on everybody, including the rabbanim, for the building of the wall. So Amar le Reish Lakish objected and said, rabbanim lo tzricha nitirusa, the rabbis don't require protection. In other words, if it's just the rabbis there, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will protect them. Now, as you might, I don't know, maybe some people wouldn't be taken aback. Some people might read this Gemara and say, this is a little, I mean, a couple of things. Firstly, it is one of the challenges, I'm going to be bluntly honest, one of the challenges is that the Rabbanon are the ones who transmit and interpret and do everything, but they also have a vested interest as well. I imagine the typical balabas who reads it and said, oh sure, the rabbis are just doing for themselves. One has to understand, and this issue comes up in the medieval period as well, about Talmud Chacham being exempt from taxes. You have to understand, firstly, what kind of Talmud Chacham this is. The Talmud Chacham who is paid by the community to serve them, it does not apply to. A Talmud Chacham who has a job, basically works all day, but he learns some. So he's not exempt from the taxes. It has to be, there's a debate about this, about how much of a Talmud Chacham. Some would say, this is not the position accepted in Shulchan Aruch, it basically has to be Torah Sanasa, all he does is sit and learn. And others would say that if he scrapes by with a bare minimum, just earns enough, just enough to feed himself, and then he spends the rest of the time learning, that's a Talmud Chacham. That's why I think it's Paskin in Shulchan Aruch. So certainly, in the United States of America, and one of the things that you see in the Gemara is that the community has responsible, even they said in the medieval period, if the government imposed a tax, a head tax, the community has to pay for the Talmud Chacham. That doesn't really exist, at least in the contemporary context in the United States or in Israel, because we don't have taxes like that. If you don't earn any money in this country, you don't pay any taxes. If you don't own a piece of property, you don't pay any real estate taxes on it. Those are not the kind of taxes that we're talking about here. Even if you had such a Talmud Chacham, but we generally speaking don't have such Talmud Chachamim, meaning our Talmud Chachamim, either they work on their own or they work for the Tzibur and they get paid by the Tzibur. Maybe they don't get paid enough, but they do get paid by the Tzibur, but it's not even like we have these kinds of taxes anyway. The taxes that the Romans were assessing were not income taxes. Property taxes is something that can be discussed because that you have a sort of line in the medieval thing. But this is not just someone who says he's a Talmud Chacham. This is that's part one. Part two, I think that one has to keep in mind that it's a very bold claim to say Rabbanan lo bai nitirusa. You have to say that it has to be an individual who could plausibly make the claim that they're on the level of tzitzus, that they actually don't need any shmirah. One could imagine, I don't know if this issue was discussed, but you know, if you're the kind of Talmud Chacham who wouldn't walk in dangerous neighborhoods at night, I'm not sure, probably this does apply, but you could raise the question if you really don't trust so much in that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to protect you, then would you then be exempt from paying for things for protection? But again, it's not an issue that that is so practical, but if you read the Gemara, it may first strike you, it's like, one second. Elsewhere, it's going to come up in the Gemara. It comes up in the second parak, actually. And the Rif quotes a related Gemara in our Sugya, I think from the Darim. There was a din of holding up the shuk for the Talmud Chacham. I mean, the Talmud Chacham comes to sell his wares. Everybody closes their stalls until he sells his stuff, and then they can go sell. Now, that doesn't fit very well with the egalitarian ethos today. It's like, what do you mean? He's in the market like everybody else. Now, the rationale behind it is because if it takes him longer, it's be mevatel from his Torah study. But when the Rambam quotes this, then apparently the sensitivity wasn't only to us. The Rambam says, because they would do that for any other Adam Chashav. In other words, if you hold the shuk for any Adam Chashav, then to not do it for Talmud Chacham is a bizayon Torah. If you hold the shuk for nobody, then that thing may not apply at all. Obviously, today, I don't think, but today, you typically don't have Talmidei Chachamim who come into the shuk to sell their minimum and they go back to learning in the base of Medrash. So it doesn't come up. But again, there is a certain sensitivity to the question of, this seems to be self-dealing in a certain sense. And it's not something that can be totally dismissed. One might say, I'm a modern person raising this question, because you have a couple of passages in the Bavli in which I think Rava accuses, and the timing seems a lot, Rav Huna, Rav Yehoshua, and Rav Papa of passing a certain dinim. He calls them a couple places in Shas, Kaki Chivari Meshalche Glimi the Inshi, white geese, meaning Rashi says they had beard, their hair was white, who stripped the clothing off people. He accused them of paskin. In one case was Nechse Ger Shemes, accused them of paskin halacha for their own financial benefit. So it's an issue that one has to be, at least even when you sit in the chair of the rabbin, and if I say, well, you should pay my taxes for me, one has to be sensitive to this perception. And the fact that the Gemara chooses to preserve those stories, I don't think is an accident. It's deliberate. Okay, so anyway, Reish Lakish gets angry and says, what are you doing? Rabbanu lo tzirich nisirusa, b'tirusa, d'chsiv esperem mechol yerbun. So the Navi, the Mizamir in Tehillim says, I will count them, they will be greater than the sands. Esperem leman. Who is he counting? Ilema le tzadikim, d'nefishim mecholma. If you're going to say, the Mizamir says, I will count the tzadikim, who are greater in number than the sand, hashta, and he's assuming the pasuk is talking about tzadikim, hashta, kulu yisrael ksibhu kachala shal svasayim, tzadikim atzim lechol yerbun, the Jewish people are like the sand of the sea, apparently like, but not more. So if the whole entirety of the Jewish people is only like the sands of the sea, how is it possible that the talmidei chacham, the tzadikim, are greater than? Elahachi ka'ama, esperem lemasehem, shel tzadikim and mechol yerbun. The good deeds of the tzadikim are greater than the grains of sand. The kavachomer umachol shemuat megina hayam maseim shel tzadikim shehim merubim lo kol shekein shemeginim aleim. If the small amount of sand compared to the ocean can keep the ocean at bay, kavachomer of the maseim shel tzadikim can keep poranus at bay. Ki asa lekame de Rav Yochanan. When Reish Lakish came in front of Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Lei, my time alo teim alo meha, why didn't you give him this pasuk? Anichol mavish shadaika migdalos, the pasuk from Shir Shirim, Anichol mazo Torah v'shadaika migdalos, elu talmidei chachamim. And if the Torah serves as a choma, then you don't need protection. Reish Lakish sabar lakididarish Rava, he didn't darsh in that way, because he said, Anichol mazo knesses Yisrael, Vishadaika Migdalos Elubate Knesios Ubate Midrashos. He didn't understand that there's a reference to Talmidei Chachamim. He understood there's a reference to the Jewish people. Right.
Back to the sort of principle of Rabbanu Tzirich Nisirusa, maybe you sort of limit where it might apply, just the principle itself. Don't we generally say, like, these are Almeis, and like you shouldn't like assume that you're right
that's why if I started to say, let's say you're a Talmud Chacham and you claim you don't need a Tirusa, and I say to you, okay, that's fine. So you feel free to walk in the middle of the bad neighborhoods at night. Do you do that? No. So we would say the following: if you're a rabbi, if you're a rabbanon, and you're in the middle of the wilderness, and you have a choice of building a stone fortification or fence around yourself to protect you from animals and people, your own, of course you have to do it because ain't so chanes. But here they're going to build a wall. The only question is, do you have to pay for it? That would be the difference. So you would say, look, you build a wall anyway. You can build a wall without me. So you pay for the wall. I don't need it because the wall's not really for me. Yes. Look, the nature of these psukim also don't sound like. They're not, you know, classic drushas. There seems to be a larger meta principle here, and I think that meta principle is that again, real talmid chacham, and a real talmid chacham means the ones who aren't supported by the community, paid for by the community, or in other words, salaried by the community, or who don't work for themselves for a living. All they do basically is spend pretty much their entire existence studying Torah, which presumably means, in some relationship, doing things for the people who get staff for the community, and may in many contexts. Be teaching Torah in the community. So basically, if they spend their entire life serving the community and barely surviving, to impose taxes upon them is ridiculous, right? They're doing, in a certain sense, when you have the masim, these kinds of masim, it's a communal, collective communal obligation as a general rule. Even when the amount of the tax may be determined in some cases, the gulgalpa, which we'll see the head tax, is based upon the number of people, but fundamentally, the taxes are a communal obligation. So if someone else is serving the community's needs, Yom Balayla, and therefore that it's, to ask them to serve in this way is not reasonable.
That makes sense, but there's nothing like that.
So what I'm saying is that when you look at these kinds of psukim, sound like asmachta.
Well, why would they make asmachta for a statement which is also not a real reason?
So the answer is because we would say the following. We would say that if you told the Balabatan this, they would say, well, don't learn, just go work and you'll pay your taxes. Right? And we would say, well, that's wrong, because a proper Jewish community needs certain resources, spiritual resources as well. Yeah, but Rehuda the Nasiya wasn't Reish Lakish either. So, if you have a better explanation, that's fine, but clearly, look, we understand clearly throughout the arc of Jewish history, the Rabbana needed the Tirusa and didn't always get it from the Rav Shaul. I understand that. So you'll make of it what you make of it. That's the best I can do with it. Gabe, okay, a question? Okay. Then Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista, Rav Chana bar Rav Chista, Rama Kraga, a Rabbanan. He put a tax on the Rabbanan. Amalei Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, Avarta Adaraisa v'Adnevi v'Adaksuve. You violated Tanakh. So even when you're showing favoritism to the nations of the world, and the Jewish people are subordinate to them, nonetheless, it should be kol kedosha biyadecha. Your holy one should be under your protection. V'heim tuku l'raglecha. Tani Rabbi Yosef, Eilu Talmidei Chachamim Shemechatetin Raglei Meir Leir Umemedina Lemedina Lilmod Torah. They wear their feet out. They grind them down, going from city to city and province to province to study Torah. Yisa Mida Berosecha Lisa Vavitein Bedevrosav Shelmachom. They wear their feet out, going from place to place just to study Torah. So that's how you violate the Torah. So Ephraim, I'll say the same thing. Does this sound like a real drasha? This screams asmachta. So that's why I assume that despite the way it's presented, and you're right, he says the Tirusa, if Talmid Chachamim always receive the protection that ostensibly they're due, then, so there are two Tirutsim. Either it's really not the real reason, or the people who need the Tirusa obviously aren't the real Talmid Chachamim. The assumption is we're building the walls of the city only because they're on the earth. The real Talmid Chacham, if it only them, they would need the wall. I don't know what the pshat in that word yisnu is, but the Gemara here is going to say And the end of the pasuk, by the way, is Vayachelu Ma'at Mimasa Melech Sarim. None of this is easy at all to explain. Gam ki yisnu v'agoyim atah kabseim. You can guess from context what yisnu might be. It might mean to be dispersed. It might mean to be there a long time. Something that says God says, even if yisnu v'agoyim, I will gather them in. The Gemara is going to darshan. Amar ula pasuk zeh v'loshen aramis nemar. It's actually an Aramaic word. I tanu kulu ata kabseim v'ma'at mehem. If all of them are studying, all of them are learning, and here the word yisnu is like mishnah. That root, by the way, does exist, but it's probably not pshat in this word. Shem yisanu tzidkos Hashem tzidkos pirshanu b'Yisrael is probably the same root as mishnah, meaning to tell over, to repeat. So here they're reading it that way. If all of them learn, so then I will redeem the Jewish people. Ve'im ma'at, it's vayachelu ma'at mimasa melcharim. So they read it ma'at vayachelu mimasa melech sarim. They will be yachelu means to be chulin, to be exempted from, to be mechulal, to be hollowed out or exempted. Rashi says lo yachel dvaro. From the masa of Malach HaSarim, from the taxes, from the burden that the king and the officers cast upon them. So if all of us learn that we'll be redeemed, if only few of us learn, so then those of us who learn, those of us who come, will be exempt from the taxes. And finally, Adiksuve, Anksuve, Mdechsiv, Mindavanova Halach, Lo Shalit Mirmalehem. So this, by the way, is in fact Pshat in the Pasuk. This refers to those who were building the Beis HaMikdash. And I think Koresh it was, basically exempted them from paying these various kinds of taxes, which the Gemara is now going to darshan what they are. So, yes, it's true. And Tosus just says, Lo shalit l'mirma alayhem, he says, V'fi shahayu oskim b'melech ha-shamayim b'min Beis HaMikdash, ha-chinami in l'hato mas alal b'tor, which afraid sounds a lot more the way I'm interpreting, the way I'm suggesting what's really behind it. As it's not... Because unless you say it, because the oskim alaf shamayim, he doesn't say they don't need it to. He says it's not appropriate to, because they're doing other stuff, so it's not fair to ask them to pay the taxes. And now the Gemara explains what are these various things. So va'amar Yehuda minda zomana samelach. Rashi, I don't think he says collection of taxes they always cast upon the medina. Aisum mana samelach actually means. You would provide the food for, let's say, the governors. And in other words, you see Shlomo HaMelech, you read the Malachim, so each one of the months had a person in charge of providing the food for the palace. So that's what I assume manas, that's usually what manas HaMelech means, unless you assume mana is a portion of money. But below, zo kesef gulgalta. Kesef gulgalta is the head tax. Gulgolas is a skull. And finally, v'helach v'halach, below v'halach, Zo Arnona. Arnona, Rashi says, and this is based upon the Gemara in Sanhedrin in the third parak. Arnona was like an asset tax, a certain percentage of Maisa from the behemos and the crops. Okay. Rapapa Rama Karya Achadata Ayasme. They were digging a well for the city, and he assessed that the costs on the Yisomim as well. Now, normally we don't assess things on the Yisomim. So, Amar le Rav Shisha bereid Rav Idi Rav Papa v'dilma lo midval. Rav Shisha said, maybe they're going to dig and not find it, and the expenses go for naught. So he said to him, Amar le Mishkal Shakil Meminayu. I collected from them. I midval midval v'ilo mahadran ala ne'ale. Only if I collected the money, but I'm going to return it. If no water is found, the assumption is the following. If the water is found, if they use this water, the Yisomim have to pay because they're using it. They're getting from it. If not, they don't have to pay, even though you and I have to pay normally, because that's the only way to do it, is because they're not b'nei mechila. So you and I, when we contribute money for digging up a well, implicit is a mechila if nothing's found. That's just the cost. But that can't be imposed upon the Yisomim. And therefore, Rav Papa said, if no water is found, then I will return their assessment to them and it'll have to come from somewhere else.
They have to contribute just because it's a communal thing. Well, and I'm saying they're benefiting. Yes, and they're benefiting. They would contribute to the wall for protection. If they get something out of it, they have to contribute.
If you are
benefiting. No. That's even if you're not b'nei mechila, because you're using it.
Yes, but I'm saying in the case that you are, does that mean that essentially you have to contribute to the community even if there's risk, even though you might lose out?
Correct. That's the assumption here. You could dig the well. And maybe it turns out to be a dry well, and that's just bad luck, right? The community has to raise more money for the next dig, and you're out your money. That's presumably, yeah. I mean, do you have a specific example? What's that? Can you give me an example that what you're thinking of? So the answer is that I don't root that in this. That's rooted in the comments of you can force the members of the city to build Beis HaKnesses, buy a Sefer Torah, and to be shown a man and to make a minyan. So I spoke about the situations where there's not either there are a minyan in town, but somebody wants to leave for a certain point, and they can force them to be mosque or someone in this place. Or the Rishonim even talk about, let's say there are only 9 people in the city, 8 people in the city, and the question of how far down, can you force other people to hire people to come, either move in or to come for the times where you need a minyan. I doubt when that situation, unless they wouldn't move in, I was going to be minyan every day, but it might have been minyan for Yom Narayim. So let's say Yom Narayim is coming in, where there are 9 of us, and one of us is not interested, and the 8 can say, sorry, you have to pony up money in order to hire somebody, to rent someone for Yom Narayim. Yeah, yeah. So in this case, it's not a monetary issue, but the proper thing to do in the community is to have a rotation. In other words, you have the people, it's understood. There are people going to attend minyan no matter what. And then to say everybody else has to understand that, there's the rotation. So when I ask you to come to minyan every day, but presumably if every person agreed to come to minyan every once a week, that would probably be more than comfortable enough to make a minyan. So yes, I'll... Yeah. No, science. So therefore, so you're saying what? No, I see. So there's nothing you can do about that, right? But you shouldn't tell him that, right? Unless you know you have. I deal with this almost every day for my minion currently, which is we run a WhatsApp group, and we have the benefit of knowing that there are many minyanim temps. Just if you live within 5 doors of me, it's very convenient. I have to say, having a shul in your living room or your driveway is very, very convenient. It has its downsides too. In your living room, it means you always have to keep things neat. But okay, we use the WhatsApp to get people to say. I have had a job, but especially during COVID, if you could give me a nickname, I was called the Count, and people would know that. Every few people, I send out a number. It's like training SEALs. I have to get people to see. To get people to come. And then when we got to 10, so you get a 10 with an exclamation point after every, but you know that if you wanted the 10, you have to show up. Of course, very often we get 3 or 4 more people who come, but so I think the right thing to do for that person is to not tell them until you have it. And it's there's no tashlum impossible there, really. But the right thing to do is to line up your ducks, So today you can do it more easily than you once could. So, unless Facebook is down, in which case the world is, even if you can't get your minion, the world is better off in sum total. So,
what's the definition of a yatim?
Of a what?
Of an orphan. Like, what does it mean to be an orphan?
What does it mean to be an orphan? And in this case, it means you're someone katanim. Once
you
reach.
You can charge, minors for the.
It means if they have an estate, the estate they inherited from their father. When we talk about you can't collect from the city of Soman, Elang Imkim Ribis Ocheles Behem. Typically speaking, it's not. They can't even incur debts themselves typically because they can't engage in commerce. In most cases, it's probably because the father had debts and he bequeathed them in the estate, and this only the estate is meshubad to pay their debts. But you don't want, right? So, but they're not in a position to defend themselves, and it's not even when they become gedolim. It's not as easy because they don't always know their father's affairs. But misom katanim were very machmir. Misom gedolim, so then there are certain protections, but they're not of the same nature. So here, I'm pretty sure this is not from the estate of their father. I mean, it might be because that maybe had they have their money, but here it's not. Here, and as if a man's father dies owing a lot of money, and then the son goes into business and makes a fortune, the son is not chayev one whit to pay. If his father didn't leave him any money, he's not chayev to pay one penny of the father's debt. He's not chayev b'dine Adam, he's not chayev b'dine Shemayim, he's not chayev on any moral level to pay back a penny of his father's debt. The only time there's either halachic and moral obligation is when he inherits, and the father owed money. Sometimes halachically the creditors can collect, and sometimes they can't. And sometimes there's a moral obligation to pay back a little bit. But fundamentally speaking, what the Yisrael make on their own, it's not even a shayach. It's not even, they owe nothing to the creditors. Here, so you certainly could never collect for a creditor, from assets the Yisrael acquired themselves, you know, of their own, really of their own accord and their own earnings and so on. Here, it wouldn't matter. In other words, here the issue is that it's not that the father owed something, it's the Yisrael owed something because they're going to use the water. So in theory, even if they somehow worked and acquired stuff, in principle, they would be liable as well. For liable from those funds. And then the Gemara says, Amar Avihuda HaKola Agle Gapa Afila Meyasme. For fixing the walls, everybody has to contribute, the Sharei HaChomos, to put in the doors, everybody has to contribute, even Yisomim, because they are benefiting from it. Avarabanan Lo Tzrichin Etirusa, the same principle. And then HaKola Karya Pasya. Rashi says Karya Pasya is to dig a well. Rabbeinu Tam says it's this road work. It's to even out the roads. You know, you get potholes, so you gotta. They're equivalent to potholes. A gavshushis is usually actually a bump in the road up. Our potholes are usually, you know, depressions. So everybody, because the Rabbanim benefit from that as well. You know, if you're a you could be the biggest Talmud Chacham in the world, but if you drive your car or have a major pothole, you're going to get a flat tire. So, v'lo amaron el delonafki b'chuluza, avonafki b'chuluza rabban elo b'nei meif b'chuluza nenu. It depends on how the potholes are repaired. If they're repaired by municipal collections and taxes and professionals are hired, then the rabbanon have to contribute. If they're repaired by all the townspeople coming out, you know, on a Sunday to fix all the potholes, then the rabbanon are potter because it's beneath their kavod. That's within the kavod haTorah. Ephraim, any question? So it's true, but they can't take, then they can't drink from the water. Because it's not theirs, they're not to steal. That doesn't mean that, nah. That means, I don't think anybody would say, they're not mechuyev if the few mitzvahs of Kriya Masay, and they may not always be, bar onshin. But you are raising a really interesting question. I never thought about it that way. You're obviously wrong. The question is why you're wrong. And I don't mean that you're wrong. You're raising a fundamental point. And many years ago, there was a Dayan who came to give shir to the Yad Yadin Kolo. I went once. I wasn't in the Yad, but I went there. He's giving a shir. And he got a lot of pushback on this idea, although he might have been right. Is there such a general notion that a person has a right to their property? even if the halacha might say there's no isser in doing X to it, there's still some kind of, I want to call it a natural right, a natural law right. And it had to do with the context of current, you know, Dayanus in Eretz Yisrael and people who aren't Jewish. I can no longer remember the exact pratim. And he was arguing that there's some such a basic entitlement to the money that you own. And I'm wondering whether, now that you ask this question, if this is really the same principle. Clearly, the Yisomim are not allowed to take the water. They have to contribute to which they're benefiting from. You know, it's almost an accessory of the sugya of Zenenev, Zechoser. It's Chayiv. And it's one thing after the fact to be Mechayiv in Ephraim, but it's another thing in advance to say you can't. In other words, everybody agrees, even by Zenenev Zelochaser, if I tell you get out of my courtyard, I can force you to get out of my courtyard. You may not have to pay me back rent if it was Zenenev Zelochaser, assuming we hold that's Pater. But you're absolutely categorically not allowed to do there if I tell you not allowed, if I tell you I want you out. So it's one thing to make the Yisum pay after they took it. It's another thing to tell the Yisum, well, it's mutter for them to take it. So you have to, but I understand what you're saying. You're asking the question, if there's no Isser of Gezel upon me, so then, is there, because someone is a katan, if there's no Isser Gezel, so what's the stop them from taking other people's properties? I assume it's a dover. I mean, the other way of explaining it is that there is an Isser Gezel, there's no onesh. But it's hard. You still have to explain why that's true by Gezel and it's not true by Shabbos. We don't assume by Shabbos. We don't assume by Shabbos that a katan is osur in Shabbos. But it's that there's no onesh. We assume that he's not mitzvah. It's only the question of whether the parents or the father or the beis din is a mitzvah chinuch. So you have to say, I think you have to say that somehow either there's some basic, protection of people's property. I hate to use the word right. Or you have to say that there's an issue gesel, it's just that there's no onesh for it. Yes, the Gemara says it too. I'll tell you. Yes, it does. My problem with Ephraim is that I'm stuck with a dissonance. I know too much about the world today. And there are plenty of Rabbanon who are buying the Tirusa. I'm probably amongst them. So I'm not quite sure, how to explain Rabbanon buying the Tirusa when maybe there are a few people who don't, but. Okay. The Gemara continues. A very striking Gemara. Rebbe Pasach Otsaros B'Shnei Batzoras. He had large assets. It was years of drought. So people were struggling. He opened up Otsaros to provide for the needs of the public. Amar, he said, Yikansu Bale Mikra. Bale Mishnah, Bale Gemara, Bale Halacha, Bale Agada. Amar Aretz Al Yikansu. He said that Talmidei Chachamim of one variety or another, greater or lesser, should come in, but Ami Eretz shouldn't come in. Dachak Rabbi Yonasan ben Amram v'nichnas. Rabbi Yonasan ben Amram must have pushed his way in and entered. He must have disguised himself because Rabbi didn't recognize him. Amar lo Rabbi Parnaseini, support me. Amar lo Bani Karisa, did you study Tanakh? Amar lo Lav. Shanisa, did you study Mishnah? Amar le Lav. In came Bama Parnaseich, on what grounds? Amar le Parnaseini Kechela v'cha'orev. Support me like the Ribbono Shalom provides food for the dogs and for the ravens. The ravens, Rashi, the Pasuk. There's some tradition that the Orev is cruel and doesn't feed its, at some point stops feeding its fledglings, and the Kaddish Baruch will make sure that they're provided with food. Regarding Kelev, Rashi says that the Kelev is misonasa muatim, and therefore Kaddish Baruch will make sure that it took a long time to digest its food so that it wouldn't be hungry so fast. So the bottom line is, he said, support me the way Ribbono Shel supports all his beings. So Parnasa, he gave him something. He gave him support. Bosar Denafak, after this person left, Yosef Revi would come at Starv, Amar Oily Shanasati Piti La Amaretz. Woe to me that I gave my food to an Amharetz. Amar Lefana Rabbi Shimon Bar Rebbe, Shema Yonasan Ben Amram Talmidchahu, Shein Arotza Lehanas Mikava Torah, Miyamav. Maybe this was actually your student. It was a Talmud Chacham, but he didn't want to be Nenem in a Torah. So, Badku Va'ashka, it turned out it was true. Amar Rebbe Yikansu Hakol. Rebbe said, let everybody come and enter. Now, this is a very hard story to understand, in that, why does Rebbe say Yikansu Hakol? And what actually was Yonasan ben Amram doing? I see two ways to read the story. One way to read the story is Yonasan ben Amram really did want to be an enemy of the Torah. Now, what was Rebbe's issue? So I think one of the Rishonim says this. Of course you have to support the Amaretz. The problem here is there wasn't enough for everybody. So who got priority? That was why Rebbe did this. But what's striking is what Rabbi Yonah Saben Avram says to Rabbi, Parnaseni kekela v'cha'orev, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mercy is upon all his creatures. The idea that you're going to say some people can take because the Talmid Chacham and other people can't take, that's not okay. And when Rabbi finally realized what had happened, he understood that that was the wrong way of doing things, and he said, you can't saw kol. Now, you could just say, he said, you can't saw kol, because maybe there's another Talmid Chacham, don't want to be nanit from the Torah. But the upshot of that then is that everybody comes in. And at the end of the story is, it doesn't matter whether you're Talmid Chacham or not, you wind up being supported. So, that shot actually that I just said about the idea that it was only because he had to prioritize, I think maybe said in Shulchan Aruch, believe it or not. Okay. Anyway, the story has always struck me. I thought that the simple reading of the story and Rebbe's conclusion is that, in fact, his original choice to do it the way he did it was wrong. Okay. And the Gemara says, Rebbe Netameh. Rebbe here was, when he adopted the policy in the first place, was following his general approach. The Amar Rebbe, Ein Puranas Bala Olam L'Shvil Amei Aretz. Puranas only comes to the world because of the Amei Aretz. If you think that this is harsh, those of you who learned Psachim with me last year in the fourth parak, and the Agadas there, and Nisim and Ephraim will probably remember, the relation, you could, if you look at the discussion of the Gemara there, Amei Aretz really, there aren't, in the firm community, there probably aren't too many people who fall into this category of Am Aretz is being described. So the Gemara tells a story here. They were people who were not the Nikra Mishnah or Derech Aretz. They were, you know, I would say that any firm kite they had only was because that's just what the community was. Right? Today, to be Shomer Shabbos in any meaningful way, even if you're not the firmest person to be Shabbos, really requires a departure from your normal routines of life. Right? Being Shomer Shabbos and being Shomer Kashrus in the world of the Tanaim did not require as major a departure from the ways of life. Right? You just didn't work on Shabbos, which was a relief. And most of the stuff that, it's not like everything of yours was electric, everything was powered by fire. Right? You know, you didn't, other than food preparation, it wasn't so much that you would have run into on Shabbos, because it was a day of rest. And keeping kashrus in a context in which, you know, Jews probably did not raise pigs and things like that, and there was no industrial production of food, or minimal. I mean, you have bread, which is, and bread wasn't so hard, that was pretty straightforward anyway. So those aren't great challenges. The difficult areas of kashrus, the Amorites were in Mizalzim, from the Semaisras. It's a very, in many, so many ways, we're very, very different than they were. They're when you learn in the Choshen Mishpat, in Simen Lamed Dalid, Amei Aretz being Pasaleidus, which is in the Gemara Psachim and Dapim Pes. So we don't have most of our Amei Aretz today. Any person of Shomer Shabbos, we don't do real Aedus, except at a wedding. We don't really use real Aedus. We use Umdana. But I don't think too many of us would pasal Edom at a wedding if they were Shomer Shabbos and Shomer Kashrus, but not terribly knowledgeable, because they would be the Derech Eretz. There was a certain kind of Derech Eretz. There are people who are civilized, who have a job, who basically observe the laws of society, and so on. So their perception, if not reality, of Am Aretz is something very, very different. Today, when I call someone Am Aretz, it means he doesn't know anything. Am Aretz, the valence here, it goes beyond just not knowing anything. Right? What's that? Why?
It sounds like if you're not positively on top of that, you are not ours. So this is being
right, except that the assumption is that in Amar it's chassid, that if you haven't studied any Torah, that I don't think is at all incompatible. I don't think this is just those who learn versus those who are very civilized but don't happen to learn. I don't think so. And when he says ain't poronis follow on the Amaretz, I don't think this is so different than that Amaretz.
Doesn't seem like there's a middle category in the story.
What's that?
In the following story, doesn't it seem like there's a middle category, not for me to come more
on? I only see two categories, right? In the next story, Kahud who de me klila, the Shadu Atraya, some crown tax. not clear what this is, that was assessed against Tiberius. Asu l'kamei de Rabbi, v'amulei lisa rabbanu madan. The people said, we want the rabbis in the academy here to contribute their shares. Amar lehu lo. He said, no. Amulei arukinan. We're going to run away then. Amulei arukusa, run away. So orku pal gehon. Half of them fled. And then there's a machlokas rishon, what happens next. The Rash quotes machlokas rabbeinu tam, and I forget who else. Dal yua palga. So Rabbi Nutam has Dayu Apalga, and they took away half and they put it on the other ones. In other words, they basically shifted the tax from the half. They didn't reduce the tax. They shifted the tax from the half who had fled, and now they, even though it's a small number of people, they just dumped it on the rest. Then Asu Hanu Palga Kamei Rabbi, the half who were left, came in front of Rabbi and said, Amalei Lesu Rabban Abadan. They said, well, you know, now the burden's even bigger, let the rabbis contribute. So Amar Lahu, Lo, no, Arukina, we're going to flee. Aruku, flee. Aruku Kule, Kulu, Pashahu Koves. All that was left besides the Rabbanan was one dry cleaner. Shadua Koves, they put the whole thing on the Koves. Arak Koves, Paka Kulila. Koves ran away and the government just did away. They just said, forget the tax. So you see, it's only because they're Amaris. Amar Rebbe, Re'isem Shein Pornis Balom, Meshvilam Ayaretz. Now, this is also very much halacha l'maisa. You're wondering, you're looking at me and say, why does this remember halacha l'maisa? So the question is, what happens when the king imposed the tax upon the Jewish community and members of the community left? Do the other members of the community, now, forget about enforcement, do they in principle have a right to say to the members who left, you owe the money, it doesn't matter that you left because the tax was assessed already, you were there. And this seems to be a machlokas rishonim as well, exactly how that works. But these were issues that really, you can imagine that the community had a responsibility, but there were lots of individuals who would do everything they possibly could to shirk their responsibility. I'm trying to remember where it comes up in Choshen Mishpat, how it comes up. I think that they talk about someone who avoids the mass, tries to evade taxes. Do they say he's in the category of Moser? Not exactly, but there's some passage about that because he was endangering the Jewish community. So taxes and tax evasion were a serious business. It's a serious business for Jews today also, but the stakes for the Jewish community are lower, other than perhaps if they're major contributors to your philanthropic causes, so then you have a problem if they get caught on tax evasion and thrown in jail. But I say that tongue-in-cheek. I don't assume that firm Jews cheat on their taxes any more or less, sadly, than anybody else in this country. I believe the primary driver is A, having the taxes to evade, and B, having the means to do so, depending on the kind of line of business you're in. Most modern Orthodox Jews are salaried, so it's harder to cheat on your taxes if you're salaried. You can nibble at the margins. If you're in business, the way the laws are written, which are corrupt, and just the very nature of stuff is not as easily traceable, it's much easier to cheat on your taxes. So I'm fairly certain that in communities in which people are mostly salaried, there's a lot less tax evasion than people who are in business. It's not a function of your religious stripes. It's a function of, as Chazal say, Lavach baraganav elach haraganav. It's not the mouse that steals, but the hole in the wall that steals. It's the opportunity. Okay. All right. Now, the Gemara now continues and says, the Mishnah said, V'kama yehe be'ir v'yehe ka'anshe ha'ir. How long do you have to be in the city before you have to then contribute to these taxes? There is a halacha that if you rent a house in Chutz La'aretz, it doesn't require a mezuzah for less than 30 days. But you have to understand what that means. If you sign a lease on an apartment in Washington Heights where there weren't the Jewish inhabitants before, and you sign a lease for 12 months, you mechuyev in a mezuzah immediately. If you're going to be there less than 30 days in the first place, then you're not chayev in a mezuzah. But if you are clearly, or if it's not clear how long you're going to be there, first 30 days doesn't require a mezuzah. But if it's clear from the get-go that you're going to be there longer 30 days, it requires a mezuzah immediately. Okay? What's that?
Is it a bitul mitzvah to be there without?
Is it a bitul mitzvah to say to
be there without?
I don't know. I mean, the answer is, you know, if you have, it's the only place you have to live, so you need to make it your priority, get as much as possible. I'm not going to tell you it's usher to live in the apartment. I'm just going to tell you it's a chiv to go get the mezuzah as soon as possible. Right? But as opposed to sometimes people think, oh, I have 30 days. The answer is no. You need to get it immediately. Right? Let's say you weren't able to get the mezuzah and the movers are coming. Would I tell you to cancel the movers? No. I would tell you, have the movers move in and then make your appointment that day to get to the sofa to get the mezuzahs.
Are there certain doors that should be prioritized?
What's that?
Are there certain doors that should be prioritized?
Totally off topic, but I'll answer the question. To the best of my knowledge, in principle, no. It's clear that, firstly, it's clear that Jews in the medieval world weren't always so machped on mezuzah and tefillin. The question was why. In Spain, it might have been, one could have imagined because some people allegorized them. But in Ashkenaz, that was not likely the case. It was probably either they didn't do it for whatever reason or it was expensive. You see this in the discussion in Karkafta de Lamanach Tfilin in Rosh Hashanah. You know why Chabad goes around getting Jews to put on Tfilin? Because they are the greatest Oave Yisrael in the world. And they know the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah that says that amongst the people who, Jews who do suffer purgatory and not clear what happens to them afterwards, Poshe Yisrael Begufan. What's Poshe Yisrael Begufan? The Gemara says, Karkafta de Lamanach Tfilin. So what does that mean? It means literally a skull, a head that didn't wear tefillin. So, the problem is that lots of Jews in the medieval world weren't wearing tefillin. But, and even basically Jews with good standing in the community. So the Baalei Tosa say that it only means someone who doesn't put on tefillin because mitzvahs are bezuyos alav. But if he can't keep a guf naki, and that's why he doesn't wear it, so then he's not a poshe Yisrael begufan. And I would add, I think probably it was expense was one of the biggest factors for Jews in Ashkenaz. So it's not that the mitzvahs were bezuyos, it's just it was too hard to do. But Chabad, I think, has adopted the interpretation, I don't know if any of you should say this, but literally it means a person who's never put on tefillin once. I believe that's how they understand. And that's why they go around with no sense of shame, and I say that in the most positive way, right? You know, in America, we like to, in religious matters, be a Jew in your home and be an American in the street. That's kind of, you know, we don't like to, it's not just here, we don't like to kind of, you know, proselytize so much. So they want to save Jews from being poshes or begufan. So they just want to get you to put on tefillin once, because they're going to save you. I mean, I think it is totally, I don't think it's shot in the Gemara, but I just, that's a separate question. And I have to say, I don't have that kind of azus netzach in the positive sense within me to go and do that. But the kala kavod to them, you know, they love Klal Yisrael so much. They want to save their souls, so that's why they do it. So anyway, mezuzahs, so there's a Ramah who comments, I think the Ramah is mezuzah in Yeridea, like from Simon Reish Pei Gimel to Reish Tzadi Aleph approximately. So the Ramah says that it's not just the main door of the house that requires. Every room in the house requires. But that tells you, of course, you can tell when the Ramah formulated, a lot of people only put it on the main door. Now, the truth is, once upon a time, I don't know if it's true in the medieval world, but in the world of Chazal, most houses probably only had one room. So you only had one mezuzah. So if you wanted to look at that and say that if you only had one mezuzah, I would never tell you that really the Medina you just need the mezuzah on the main door, but not there. No, Medina you need every doorway that requires a mezuzah. But if you only had one, I would probably put it first. The sofa only had one, and he's ordering more, and you're getting more. I would tell you first to put it on the main entrances to the outside. But every door, you know, every door is a priority. Okay, so now the Gemara says, "V'kamei be'ir v'anshe'ir," the Mishnah had said, "Yud beis chodesh." So they ask a question, a contradiction. V'reminhi, ha'chameres v'hagameles overes v'makom l'makom v'lana b'socha v'hut chaymahim. So the halacha is, in Ir HaNidachas, a city where a majority of the inhabitants worship Avodah Zarah, when an individual worships Avodah Zarah, the death penalty is skila, and what happens to the person's assets? They go to the person's heirs. You know, you kill them and someone inherits from them. Ir HaNidachas is a unique din where a majority of the city worshipped Avodah Zarah, and this has to be handled by the Sanhedrin HaGadol. And if they find, in fact, that such is the case, a majority have worshipped Avodah Zarah, they're all convicted. So then they raise the city. The tzaddikim are allowed to survive. The wives and children of the idol worshippers may be a machlokas harishon and what happens to them. And then they burn the city to the ground with all the assets, even nichsei tzadikim. Even nichsei tzadikim. The mamonim is not palat. But the death penalty for the worship idol worshippers is cherev. And whoever gets killed is cherev, which is a less severe form of the death penalty. It's hereg rather than skila. So there's a chumra and a kula for each, whether yachad or rab. So if you have a chameres or a gameles, you have a caravan of camels with their... Camels are not the problem. The problem are the camel drivers. And a caravan of donkey drivers who are passing through the city and they stay there, and they worship Avodah Zarah too. So hein b'skila, the members of the chameres and the gameles, even though the rest of the city is getting killed by cherev, the chameres and the gameles who stayed overnight and worshiped Avodah Zarah, they get skila umamonam palat, but their money goes to their heirs. The money escapes. But if they were there for 30 days, it was an extended stop for the caravan. They were there for 30 days and they worship Avodah Zarah, then they are killed. Besayef and their mamon, their property is destroyed. The Gemara here doesn't say anything about it, but I assume that they actually factor in another important way also if they stay 30 days, which could be lekula lechumra, which is that it has to be a majority, it has to be a rove of the city that worshipped. So if they haven't been there for 30 days, they're not part of the headcount of the city. If they've been there for 30 days, then the city's population is increased by their number, and then depending on how many of them worshipped Avodah Zarah, it could be they could end up tipping the city to the minority of idol worship. Let's say none of the chameres or the gamelis worshipped Avodah Zarah, and there were 30 of them, and there were 100 people in the city where 60 people worshipped Avodah Zarah and 40 people didn't. Now, if the 30 members of the caravans had been there for 30 days or more, they would now be mitzaref to the 40 who didn't worship Avodah Zarah, and it would turn out to be a minority of the city that worshipped Avodah Zarah, and the 60 people who did would get skila, and their monam would be palat. But the problem is, our Mishnah says 12 months, and yet the Braiso, it's a Mishnah probably, it gives them 30 days. So the Gemara says, Amar Rava Lokasha, Hola Vnei Masa, Hola Yisuve Masa. To be a citizen of the city, a Ben Masa, to count, to have to pay all the different taxes, and the Gemara is actually going to qualify it, it's going to give different amounts. So there, there you have to be 12 months. But to be the Yisuve Masa, which are Hake Sake, es Yoshveha here Alefiharev, that you only need 30 days. Kedetanya. Hamuder me hanoa me anshe ha'ir. If you take a neder not to get hanoa from anshe ha'ir, kol shenishtashem shnemer shachodesh aser lehanas vimenu. Pachas mikan mutter. Your hanoa, your neder not to get hanoa from anshe ha'ir is only for those who are living there 4 months. But if you took a neder miyoshe ha'ir, kol shenishtashem shloshem aser lehanas vimenu, pachas mikan mutter lehanas vimenu, mutter lehanas. So I mentioned the mezuzah thing because there appears to be a machlokas harishonim here, and some very important things as well in the Rush quotes. Whether or not, if you rent a house, you move to the city. It's meant to be permanent, you know, at least permanent as far as you know. So do you say it has to be 12 months before you pay the mas or not? So first the Rush quotes, right in that very same region, it's probably Simen Chav Ches, I'm betting. What's that? No, so that's in Kanaba Beis Dira. But let's say you rented something, for example. So, where is it? I thought it's right here. Quotes are very important. You show me also. Where is this passage? It's hiding from me. I can't find it now. He quotes one day who says, you move in with the intent of staying there, you're bound immediately. And others push back a little bit, and they quote a very important Yerushalmi about the halacha overrides. This is such an important formulation, and it really bothers me that I can't find it right now. But I don't see it. I'm trying to think where it would have been if it's not in the rush. Okay, so anyway, I thought he quoted Rabbeinu Baruch, actually, but maybe he wasn't, who said that you're a citizen of the town. If you're intending to stay, if you move into where you can stay, you're bound immediately. You're bound immediately. Oh, wait one second. Maybe it's earlier. No. Okay. So the Gemara now says, is that true? Ulechol milei miba inin beis chodesh. You need 12 months for everything. To be mi bnei ayir. Vatanya shloshim yom tamchui. Tamchui, and this is going to launch the sugyas of tzaka. So we'll just finish to the tudas. The tamchui was a place that they collected food. Food ready to eat. Food they would go around every day to distribute. Well, the Gemara will say it's primarily meant for aniyim passing through, not for the ani ayir. So to have to contribute to the tamchui, you have to be there 30 days. Shlosha chadashim lekupa. The kupa was the money that was collected on a weekly basis, cash, to provide to the poor people of the city, to provide them with their weekly needs. Shisha liksus. To have to contribute to clothing the poor people, you have to be there 6 months. Tisha lekvura. 9 months to have to pay for the free burial society for the poor. And shneim asar. Lefase ha'ir, to contribute to the walls of the city, 12 months. Amar Rasi, Amar Biyokanor, ki tanan mes nisan, shneim es ha'chodesh lefase ha'ir tanan. And that's exactly what Mishnah was talking about, protection of the city. There you have to be a resident for 12 months in order to be obligated than that, but short of that you wouldn't be. But for the various kinds of hilchos tzedakah, depending on what the contribution is, determines how long you have to be there before you're a chayiv to contribute. Let me read. I'm going to read just one more line from Rav Asi and Rav Yochanan. I call the fast that year afilim yasme, aval rabbanan lo. The rabbanan lo tzricha nitirusas. I think we really saw almost that earlier. Amar Papa l'shua l'parsha l'tarzina afilim yasme, aval rabbanan lo tzricha nitirusa. Shura is the wall. Parsha, Rashi says, are the guard, the soldiers who go around the city, sort of serving a guard duty. And tarzina, Rashi has an interesting etymology. Tar, Zayana, means those who watch the armory, those who watch the weapons of the city. Even the Yisomim benefit from, but the Rabbanon don't have to contribute. Klalo de Milsa. Ko Milsa de Istu Hanamine Afila Miyasme. Anything that they get benefit from, the Yisomim have to contribute. Okay. And I'll stop here. The Gemara now is going to launch into starting talking about Tzedakah and its obligations. The main sugyas of tzedakah and shas are found here, and are found in the ksuvos at the beginning of the sixth parak. And here, it's all because of what we're about to see. Pidyon shvuyim and the yisomim is going to be the impetus for hilchos tzedakah.